Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Tuesday, the funerals began. Two brothers, Cecil and David Rosenthal, were among the first of the 11 victims of Saturday's mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh to be buried. More than 1,000 people attended. Dr. Jerry Rabinowitz from Squirrel Hill was also buried, as lines of mourners stretched around city blocks. And then on Tuesday afternoon, President Trump arrived in Pittsburgh, accompanied by the First Lady, his daughter, and his son-in-law. But local and national leaders refused to appear with the president, and after the funeral services ended, a quiet, peaceful protest began. More than 16,000 people signed a letter to the president written by a group of Pittsburgh's Jewish leaders. Quote, President Trump, you are not welcome in Pittsburgh, the letter read. The country often looks to leadership in times of tragedy and someone who can identify with those mourning and help direct the nation towards a higher, better place, a place of healing. But President Trump appears unable or unwilling to play that role.
I think historians will be extremely critical of the way that Donald Trump reacted to this worst attack on Jewish Americans in worship in 200 years.
Michael Beschloss is a presidential historian and author most recently of Presidents of War, and he spent his career researching and writing about the roles and expectations of the presidency.
Presidents of wartime have always had to go to funerals, console, you know, families of soldiers who have fallen on the battlefield because of their own decisions. And that's one reason you've always wanted to have presidents with empathy. For instance, Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War was told that there had to be a national cemetery, a new one, because so many soldiers were dying. And Lincoln said, put that cemetery right near my summer home so that I can see the Union graves being dug. I want to see the results of the terrible decisions I'm making that are creating an ocean of blood. And also, I want to be able to console the widows.
And, you know, you mentioned Abraham Lincoln. I want to move the clock forward to Ronald Reagan and how he dealt with national tragedies. I'm thinking specifically about the explosion of the Challenger space shuttle in 1986 that I remember clearly.
Ronald Reagan was almost designed for this role of a president consoling the nation after a tragedy. 1986, Americans saw with their own eyes the Challenger accident, and Ronald Reagan gave a speech late that day that was one of the best written speeches probably in the history of the presidency, talking about what America aspired to in the space program and giving some context to what had happened that morning.
And I want to say something to the school children of America who were watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff. I know it's hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The Challenger crew was pulling us into the future, and we'll continue to follow them.
We also are thinking about other presidents since Reagan. What comes to mind is the Oklahoma City bombing and Bill Clinton's response to that.
You have lost too much, but you have not lost everything. And you have certainly not lost America, for we will stand with you for as many tomorrows as it takes.
How would you assess that?
Well, the interesting thing, that was in the spring of 1995, and Bill Clinton at that time was a very controversial president. He had just lost both houses of Congress, so this is not someone who was considered to be a hugely popular leader. But when he gave a speech explaining what had happened in Oklahoma City and trying to tell Americans that American history shows that we get over these things, it made him more of a president.
Now, I also want to bring up George W. Bush, who had what I recall were sort of two very different experiences with really consoling the nation. One was after Katrina.
So we can stabilize the situation. Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
Not his finest hour.
Not his finest hour. Lots of Americans felt that he was being insensitive, right, to the plight of those who had suffered. But then there was 9/11.
I can hear you!
Two things stand out. You know, the moment that we all remember, which is that he went down to Ground Zero and spoke through a bullhorn and he said,
I can hear you, the rest of the world hears you, and the people...
And I think the more important thing, Tanzina, was that he went to a mosque.
These acts of violence against innocents violate the fundamental tenets of the Islamic faith. And it's important for my fellow Americans to understand that.
And he was very specifically trying to make the statement, although the people who perpetrated 9/11 were who they were, that should not cause Americans to act against Muslims, and Muslim Americans were a big part of the American family, shows how a president can heal and unite and inspire. Those are essential parts of what a president does.
9/11 was obviously a major flashpoint in American history, and we're still dealing with the ramifications of this almost 20 years later. And I'm wondering, how have Americans changed in their expectations of what a president should be in these moments? Or has it changed? Do we have higher expectations now after a 9/11? And I'd like to talk a little bit about President Obama here as well.
I think we do have higher expectations, and remember how President Obama reacted to the church shooting just a few years ago when he sang Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved.
That's something that everyone remembered, and a lot of people found that very healing. Presidents have to always remember that half of their job is to be a political leader who proposes policies that make a lot of people angry, but the other half of the job is to be head of state. And head of state means unifying and comforting after a moment like this.
Then President Obama also was very emotional after the Sandy Hook shootings and killings, and he was criticized in some ways for that. He was also criticized for not lowering the flag after five soldiers were killed in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in a terror attack there. So how do presidents toe that line?
You're always measuring a president against perfection. And, you know, Benjamin Franklin once said, our critic is our friend. One of the ways that we have to criticize presidents is how they react to national tragedy. And yes, you're absolutely right. Barack Obama, the frustration we heard him express after all those school shootings, saying, once again, I have to come out here and talk about an event like this. I'd hope that the last one would have been the last.
As a country, we have been through this too many times, whether it's an elementary school in Newton or a shopping mall in Oregon, or a temple in Wisconsin, or a movie theater in Aurora, or a street corner in Chicago. These neighborhoods are our neighborhoods, and these children are our children.
Now, I'm also thinking about, obviously, this segment comes on as Pittsburgh is healing. There have been lots of different reactions to the current president, President Trump, going to Pittsburgh in light of the synagogue tragedy. And how does a president make that determination? I mean, if a community is saying, or at least parts of a community are saying, don't come, does it hurt the president to go?
I think it is up to the president concerned, but if the heartfelt feeling of a community is that you're going to help us heal faster by waiting a couple of days, I think it's not a bad idea to wait a few days. And I think historians will be extremely critical of the way that Donald Trump reacted to this worst attack on Jewish Americans in worship in 200 years. He talked about maybe they would have been protected had they been better armed. And he also went ahead with a campaign rally that evening. I can't think of any other president of our time who would have done that.
Well, and I'm also thinking back to Charlottesville and the reaction post-Charlottesville.
You had a group on one side that was bad, and you had a group on the other side that was also very violent. And nobody wants to say that, but I'll say it right now. You had a group on the other side that came charging in without a permit, and they were very, very violent.
You know, at what point does the American public just give up on expecting a president to be this sort of moral and leader and consoler in chief?
We will never give up. And we will always demand that a president do that because it's an essential part of his job. And the other thing is that at the very least, we would expect a president not to rub salt into the wounds. Another thing that Donald Trump did that day was to pronounce himself yet again a nationalist. A nationalist is an extremely loaded word. It appeared in the title of a book by George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazi Party, which was called The Nationalist Perspective. The subtitle was White Power. So at best, he said it inadvertently. At worst, on this tragic day, he used it to send dog whistles to help himself politically. I hope it wasn't the latter.
What are the risks as a country if we don't have a president who shows, like you said, that level of empathy, who's able to connect with Americans during these tragedies?
It's a big loss to all of us because I think we have come to depend on a president framing a tragedy like this and explaining to us how we can get over it. That's something of our modern time. And I think when we don't have a president who's able to do that, and I think that is just not in Donald Trump's toolbox, then we've got a little bit of a problem.
And it would appear that Americans are still having vigils. They're still connecting. Yesterday, for example, in Pittsburgh, there was the head rabbi and also the head of the Islamic Cultural Center there were connecting. So I'm wondering if outside of having a president who's able to do this, whether or not Americans themselves can step in and fill the void.
Of course they can. And that's what the founders wanted. You know, they knew that you could elect presidents and some of them would do certain things well, and some presidents would do things extremely badly. And they always had faith in the wisdom of the American people, if there was a vacuum like that, to do it for themselves.
Michael Beschloss is a presidential historian and author most recently of Presidents of War. Michael, thank you again.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Since taking office, Donald Trump has never really stopped campaigning, often returning to speak in towns and cities across the country where support for his presidency remains high.
That's happening.
But as the midterm elections approach, Trump is spending even more time on the campaign trail, trying to lift fellow Republicans in tight races in an effort to maintain control of Congress. And in order to keep his base energized, the president is keeping his messaging simple.
Those who violate our laws and cross our borders illegally will be sent back home quickly. And we tell them that because they've got a long hike, but they can't come. They cannot come in the way they want to come in. Doesn't work that way.
With less than a week to go, will the president's message motivate his core supporters to turn out like they did in 2016? Here to discuss is Christopher Catalago, a White House reporter for Politico. Christopher, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about the president's messaging here. As we said, we've got 1 week before the midterm elections. What are some of the big themes that the president is really knocking hard? We've got, obviously, immigration. What else are you seeing?
The president is going very hard on illegal immigration, as you mentioned. He has brought up a very unlikely proposal, but one that he thinks is going to motivate folks, which is a 10% tax cut on the middle class. The president has continued his barrage of assaults on the media. And in the last few days, he has really dialed up his critique of the Democratic Party. That is meant as something to really unify Republicans, pointing to what he sees as kind of the extremes of the Democratic Party.
You know, and I'm wondering, the president has made no secret of his thoughts on migrants coming from Central America, from Mexico, with the very beginning of his campaign. So is there a reason why he's still really doubling down on immigration? And what does that strategy tell us as opposed to healthcare or as opposed to other issues that he should be looking at?
This is an election that's really based on motivating his base, nationalizing this election around his supporters. Because the question that Republicans have always had is, there were a number of people who turned out for Donald Trump, much of them Republicans, but not all of them. And the question was, would they come out and turn out for a member of Congress or a candidate for the House? And that has been a much tougher thing to answer. And so if Donald Trump goes out there and says, this midterms is really about me, my policies are on the ballot. You'll remember Barack Obama said that and it turned into a scandal. Well, Donald Trump has been saying that exact thing. And it's a way for him to make this about himself and a way to really sort of rile up his supporters. What I would say about illegal immigration that he's focused on is this has been a constant focus, as you pointed out. I mean, going back to the beginning of his campaign, obviously earlier this spring, he went really hard on the MS-13 gang and started using terms like animals to describe people, which generated a lot of backlash. And so what he's doing is we flash forward to the beginning of October, and the president's political team started to get a whole bunch of polling and data come back to them about this issue of immigration, saying that in a lot of these marginal districts, these competitive House districts where Donald Trump is not always seen as a help, illegal immigration was resonating with folks. This whole idea of the Republican Party being sort of the protectors of immigration and customs agents. There was an abolish ICE movement on the left, obviously. And so that whole issue was resonating. And what happened was the president sort of had this migrant caravan issue sort of land in his lap after they had already decided that they were going to really close on illegal immigration.
Well, and there's also the recent news that the president has decided to send troops to the southern border. We should also remind our listeners that this migrant caravan, if you will, the folks who are migrating, are still weeks away from even reaching the United States border. So the president's doubling down on sending troops and reinforces the idea that these folks are almost the scapegoats in many ways, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these attacks, a lot of these statements are not grounded in reality. As you mentioned, these people are hundreds of miles away. They would not reach here, like you said, for weeks. And then in the last day or so, there's been this issue of ending birthright citizenship, which has been really sort of the third rail, and it has come up and it has worked in the president's favor. It was obviously a question from a reporter. It was not something the White House proactively put out there.
Well, let's take a listen to that, because I want to hear that clip, and then I want us to sort of break that down.
On immigration, some legal scholars believe you can get rid of birthright citizenship without changing the Constitution.
With an executive order.
Exactly.
Right.
Have you thought about that?
Yes.
Tell me more.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. 14th Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely,
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order.
I think the president was very frustrated, and the folks around him were very frustrated over the last few days, because the narrative, as folks go head to the polls in a lot of these states that have early voting, was all about domestic terrorism. There was this terrible shooting in Pittsburgh, and you know, everybody sees these things as the tragedies that they are. But we have to say that what Republicans have been saying all along, they knew this was going to be a very tough midterm elections. Donald Trump knew that as well. And what they were saying was, you know, all these issues come up and they last for, you know, a few days, a day or two, and then they dissipate. And so they never really knew where we would end. What would we be talking about when voters finally start going to the polls? And they were talking about these domestic terrorism issues that were not seen as a help to the party. So the president saw the migrant caravan, despite the fact that it was never going to reach the border anywhere near Election Day, as a political gift. That was the term that the folks around him were using. And then I would say the same thing for this question that came up yesterday. I mean, these are things that are going to come up. And what he's doing, even if it's not something that they're generating, they're able to amplify these stories and to really give them life. And I think that if that is something that allows them to turn the page on the type of narratives that they don't find helpful, they're going to do that. So he has a way to sort of direct what we are thinking about and talking about, and he's been trying to use that to effect before the midterms.
Christopher Catalago is a White House reporter for Politico. Christopher, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Over the past 20 years, the number of refugees and migrants worldwide has more than doubled. In 1997, there were more than 33 million displaced people around the world, and now that number is at 68 million. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, more people have been forced to leave their homes today than at the end of World War II. And unlike what you might think, more of them are moving to cities. A new report released today from the International Rescue Committee looks at more than 20 cities throughout the world and their efforts to integrate these refugees. Los Angeles is one of the cities that was profiled, and I spoke to Linda Lopez, the director of the Los Angeles Mayor's Office on Immigrant Affairs, alongside Samer Saliba, urban advisor for the International Rescue Committee and co-author of the report.
One of the main goals of the report was to sort of dispel the misconception that refugees and internally displaced are living in dusty camps in the middle of nowhere. That's just not the case anymore in 21st century displacement. Nearly 60% of refugees and about half of internally displaced are not living in camps, but in towns and cities. And actually, if you look at the refugees coming from Syria, that number actually jumps up to 90%. So those Syrian refugees who are in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, those kinds of countries are the vast majority of them are not in camps, but in towns and cities. And so what we wanted to do with this report was just really get a global snapshot of what that looks like and how city governments around the world are at the front lines of displacement worldwide and what city governments are doing to address that.
And you know, we've talked a lot about the migration here in the United States. You know, it's been everything from becoming a political talking point to being an important issue that we really need to address here. But this is an issue globally. Tell us a little bit about what that snapshot looks like.
Globally, there are over 68 million people displaced currently, right now. Every 2 seconds, a person is forced from their homes by fear and violence. So at the International Rescue Committee, where I work, now is the time where we're being called, our country's offices are being called to action, you know, greater than we ever have before. And so that's the sort of framework that we're working within. At the same time, the world is going to be 75%, I believe, urban by 2050. So the world now is more urban than it is not. And urban displacement is happening within the wider framework of urbanization. And so we as a humanitarian organization, you know, displacement is at its highest, urbanization is at its highest. What we need to do is really ring the bell on the need for preparedness, the need to work with city governments, the need for solutions over rhetoric, and to really focus on how we can support those at the front line who are dealing with displacement now, but also will be dealing with displacement as it grows into the future.
And you talked about those on the front lines. Linda, I want to bring you in here. Can you tell us a little bit about Los Angeles's history with refugee resettlement specifically?
Yeah, of course. You know, Los Angeles has been a destination city for not only refugees, but immigrants. 40% of LA's population is born outside of the U.S. The International Rescue Committee has had an office in the LA area and supporting refugees since 1975. So their presence has been incredibly important in the resettlement process, particularly in a place like LA, where you have more than 200 languages spoken. In terms of our diversity and the range of, you know, cultures and people. So I think that for a place like LA, especially in light of the more, you know, recent caps on refugee resettlement generally in the United States, it is so important that we continue that work here locally.
And Samer, Linda mentioned the cap. As you're doing this reporting, the U.S. administration recently capped the number of refugees that could be settled within the U.S. in 2019 to 30,000, which is the lowest since 1980. How does that number, that cap, shape the work that you're doing in this report or future work?
Well, it certainly doesn't make it easier. And what we're really trying to do with this report is highlight the fact that member states and national governments are coming up with these policies, but these policies do not reflect the reality. The reality is that refugee populations can actually be a benefit to local communities and to cities themselves. And that's the opportunity that all cities have. It's just a matter of providing with the resources that a city like Los Angeles or a city like New York has to cities like Kampala, Uganda, or to Mogadishu, Somalia. And so just the needs looking forward are dramatic. And the current policies and discourse at an international level is not recognizing that reality.
Linda, give us a sense of what are the essential components that help refugees adjust in LA.
One of the areas that we've been very focused on is how do we, for example, enroll children who are immigrants or, you know, are refugees or asylum seekers here in our city? And we have some great partnerships that we've developed with our local school district. We have a specific center that's designated for, you know, unaccompanied minors, for example, who have come to the city, and to also help their parents, not only with enrollment, but also with mental health services and other wraparound services that I think have been very important in their integration.
And Linda, we also know that the Office of Refugee Resettlement said that it expects that half of all the families separated by the U.S. administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy will actually be detained in greater L.A. Is the city prepared for that influx of folks?
We're very prepared. We, in fact, coordinated a strategy with the county. One of the things that we've done immediately, because cities are first responders in many cases when we have, you know, populations that arrive, is to also provide legal representation and working with local legal organizations that are representing some of the families that have been reunified. And we've also created, under Mayor Garcetti and the county, the LA Justice Fund, which is a fund that provides legal assistance to immigrants, asylum seekers, refugee populations, domestic violence survivors who are eligible for, you know, T visas or U visas. So it's a public-private partnership that allows for people to get that legal representation, especially those who are facing deportation.
And, you know, we established that this is not just a domestic issue. This is an international issue. And we've seen waves of migration continually, not just coming here to the United States, throughout Central America, throughout the EU. You know, I mean, this is not something that's going to stop. In fact, it might even increase given climate change and everything else that we've laid out. I'd like to ask you both, what do you think are the biggest challenges that cities will face in the next 10 years? Samer?
It's preparedness, I think, number one. You know, I mentioned the example of Kampala. When I speak with city officials and tell them that your city will be the biggest city in the world in about 30 years, they simply do not have the resources to deal with that. The point is it takes all hands on deck to think not just reactively, which is very much how I think the international system has worked, but not being surprised when you see this amount of people show up on your doorstep, because this is the trend, as you mentioned, and it has been for decades.
And Linda, what about you? What do you think the biggest challenges cities will face over the next 10 years?
Housing. It's also access to education. You know, we're not going to see declines in the number of people that are arriving to destination cities like LA or New York or Chicago. I think it's imperative that leaders take that challenge and really create not only the infrastructure, but also think through how other partners can come along in this process of agenda setting for their integration.
Linda Lopez is the director of the Los Angeles Mayor's Office of Immigrant Affairs, and Samer Saliba is the urban advisor for the International Rescue Committee. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
We turn back now to the Saudi-led war in Yemen. And today, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis called for a ceasefire.
We've got to move toward a peace effort here, and we can't say we're going to do it sometime in the future. We need to be doing this in the next 30 days. We've admired this problem for long enough down there.
The United States has long been criticized for aiding the Saudis in the war. By most estimates, well over 2 million Yemenis have been displaced, and the humanitarian crisis is of a scale that's hard to fathom.
Even having been there several times before, I was shocked at how bad it had become.
New York Times staff photographer Tyler Hicks has made three trips to the war-torn country, his latest just this month. And what he found there was unlike anything he'd seen before. On Tuesday's program, we talked to the New York Times' Declan Walsh, whose recent reporting shares vivid details of the desperate state of millions of civilians in Yemen, a country now at the brink of famine. Accompanying that report were portraits captured by Tyler Hicks, showing children and babies starving to death in the north of the country, and the bloody conflict ongoing in the south. I spoke to Tyler today about those photographs.
Yemen's a very difficult place to work. There are a lot of distance to cover, lots of checkpoints. But there were a few places that we'd heard that people were really suffering. And these are areas where people are coming from a pretty large region and getting to just a couple of really clinics. I mean, these aren't so much hospitals as we would think of them back home. These are very small clinics where people come and however they can. We found out there a lot of the problems is just the economy. There's absolutely no money being earned by people. People don't have jobs. They don't have money to get to these hospitals. Fuel is very expensive and hard to come by, and it costs a lot of money for them. They're having a hard time just feeding their families, let alone going many hours in a vehicle to get to a clinic. That's how we chose to go to these specific areas.
Now, the piece that you did for the New York Times, one of the first images that readers will see when they open the piece is a photo of a young girl named Amal. Can you describe the photo for our listeners and tell us a little bit about what you were seeing and experiencing and really what struck you about Amal?
I'd been to a few hospitals, a few clinics around the north, and when I walked into this particular one in a place called Aslam, I could tell that the moment that I walked in that this was really where some of the worst cases were. It's a kind of open corridor with rooms surrounding it, and just looking from that central area without even entering the rooms, I could see that the children there were really in terrible shape, skin and bones. And the first room that I went into, I saw this young girl, Amal, and the poor child was just laying on a cot, her ribs just showing completely through her skin. There wasn't an ounce of fat on her. Her arms and legs just like toothpicks. It's just very, something about her face also. She's very calm child who, when you see her body, is just heartbreaking. And I spent a lot of time photographing her. I knew that as difficult as this photograph was to take, and as difficult it is for the viewers to see, I knew that this was going to be an important picture and an important photograph to be seen, because she really sums up how tragic and how bad the malnutrition and the starvation has really become in Yemen.
And Tyler, there is often a debate about traumatic images, right? On the one hand, people will say they're just too traumatic to publish and to look at. And on the other hand, there are people who say, are they exploiting, people who are in their most vulnerable state? And as a photojournalist, I'm wondering, how do you grapple with those issues?
I never take photographs that are difficult to look at just for the sake of getting a dramatic photo. Sometimes there's a reason to document things that can be difficult to look at. And this is one of those cases. There's a lot of decision that goes into both taking the photographs, then to file the photographs to the New York Times. And then there's a whole team of people there who decide whether that image or images will appear in the newspaper. This is one of the cases where I think it's really important for these photographs to be seen. I mean, there has not been a lot of coverage out of Yemen. It's a very difficult place to get to because the travel restrictions there, Western journalists have not been invited very often to go there. So when we can see what's happening, that's an opportunity for us to show what's happening in the country, as difficult as it is.
And Tyler, have we become desensitized to images like this and the crisis in Yemen overall? Because I just think back to, 2 years ago when there was an image of a toddler for the Syrian refugee crisis, and this toddler, you know, was dead on the beach, on the shore. And I just think that image was so powerful. Like, are we becoming desensitized to the horrors out there because we're just, there's so much going on right now?
I think yes, but at the same time, that doesn't affect the way I think that I should be doing my job or about how the media should be covering these places. You can't try to deconstruct what people's sensitivities are and in effect quarantine what you choose to show. I think it's the more people become used to these things, actually the more that you should be out there covering them because people need to be reminded of what's happening out there. But all that being said, it's extremely important to keep the tempo up and to continue to get these images out there and to have them seen and to get a reaction from them. And of course, some people will disagree with that. They'll think that these photographs shouldn't be shown. Why would you show, you know, these children who are starving to death? I mean, there's another photograph that ran as part of that. I was at the same hospital, and as people were bringing in their sick children, often with their mothers being completely malnourished and unable to breastfeed or to give any nutrition for them. And it was a child photographed, and 8 hours later, that child died. I found out the next day. And that's just incredibly heartbreaking to be witness to such a young and innocent life that then is just gone. You know, you hear it the next day, though, that child died. And the people who are volunteering and working in these clinics, they're kind of becoming used to it.
Tyler Hicks is a staff photographer for The New York Times. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
40 years ago, a teenage babysitter named Laurie Strode was terrorized on screen by a mass killer.
Just listen to me. When you go down the stairs and out the front door, I want you to go down the street to the McKenzie's house. I want you to tell them to call the police and tell them to send them over here.
This Halloween, Laurie's back in theaters, once again facing off against Michael Myers, and their original confrontation still haunts her.
It took priority over your family. It cost you your family.
If the way I raised your mother means that she hates me, but that she's prepared for the horrors of this world, then I can live with that.
Viewers across the country have been turning out in droves to watch the older, wiser version of Laurie, played by the actor Jamie Lee Curtis. The new Halloween boasts the biggest movie opening ever for a female lead over 55. But while it's exciting to see Curtis return to the role, the movie's credits have spooked some female horror fans. The original Halloween was co-written by writer-producer Deborah Hill, and the 2018 version was written by three men. I have two guests here to discuss how women fit into the horror genre. Mary Lambert is the director of the classic Stephen King adaptation, Pet Sematary. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
And Monica Castillo is a freelance film critic for RogerEbert.com. Monica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start by reading a quote from the producer, Jason Blum, who produced The New Halloween, along with a lot of other horror movies, including Get Out and Paranormal Activity. A couple weeks ago, when a writer for the website Polygon asked him why he hadn't produced any horror movies made by female directors, Blum said this, and I'm quoting here, quote, "There are not a lot of female directors, period, and even less who are inclined to do horror." He apologized for that comment soon after, but I'd love to get both of your reactions to it.
I mean, it sounds so much like the conversation that's going around Hollywood where people are saying, oh, I don't know where the directors of colors are. I don't know where women directors are. And the problem is that they're out there and people need to actually take the time to find them.
Mary, what are your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, I'm glad he apologized later for the remark because it's just not true. I mean, I've tried to pitch projects over there and like been sort of relegated to somebody low level that listened to my pitch and that was it, you know? Hmm. They know I'm out here.
Well, you've done it. You've actually done it. So that's the proof right there.
You know, exactly.
I want to ask you, Monica, you've actually seen the new film, The New Halloween, and I will be honest, I'm a scaredy cat, so I'm afraid to see some of these films. But I'm curious about how the new film dealt with the main character's trauma compared to the original film. What did you think?
Well, I mean, the original film was such a landmark moment, and it really like kind of kicked off a sort of like serial killer subgenre, in essence. But now they're looking at what are the after effects of all that? What happens when decades later come in and Laurie is still dealing with that trauma? She never got help for any of the things that she experienced. And it transferred down to the generation. So it affected how she related to her daughter and how she relates to her granddaughter. And I thought it was a very interesting concept. And I think what a lot of people want to see is what that would have looked like in the hands of a woman writer, of a woman director.
And the original Halloween, as we mentioned in the introduction, was co-written by a woman, Deborah Hill. Mary, I'm wondering, does that movie feel different from other horror classics that didn't have women behind the camera? What's your perspective on that?
I mean, it was co-written by Deborah Hill, who was kind of a real force. I worked with Deborah on a television anthology series back in the 90s, and I knew her, and she was really committed to her profession. She was committed to the creative aspect of it. So it had to have affected it. I mean, she helped to create a seminal piece of filmmaking, you know, a character that lives in the imagination of millions of people.
And Mary, again, you directed Pet Sematary. I'm wondering, what has your experience been in as a woman in the horror, the genre of horror in Hollywood?
You know, I had a really big success early in my career with the Stephen King adaptation. I had a great experience working with Stephen, who I wouldn't have gotten to direct the movie if it weren't for Stephen. He had control over who would be the director. He had the final say on that. And I met with him, and I know that he promoted me. I know that's the reason that I was hired. So I had a big success with that, and it led nowhere, you know?
And we hear this a lot, as Monica pointed out earlier, when we're talking about communities of color or underrepresented communities in Hollywood in general. I want to pivot a moment here to the actual, to the content again and how women are portrayed. And Monica, I'm curious about your thoughts on this horror movie trope known as the final girl. Can you tell us what that is and what it represents?
Sure. So that's the trend when you're watching a horror film and then there's usually only one survivor and she tends to be a woman. And, you know, it's supposed to be this big empowering figure that she survived everything that took out her friends or took out her loved ones. And my take on it right now is that it's kind of ossified for me. It's kind of stuck in the past. I don't, you know, see it really progressing that much in the films that I've seen recently. What I'm interested in is something like this recent Halloween movie where it's not just one Laurie Strode at the very end. It's a united front of women. It's the three generations of Strode who are standing up against Michael Myers. Mm.
So, Mary, in terms of the final girl, having been, you know, you did Pet Sematary, what do you think about that role for women in horror? Is it empowering? Is it supposed to be empowering? Do you think it's a trope that needs to be done away with?
Well, it can be empowering. I mean, the person who's left is the person who the sequel is about. I personally wanted to see a Pet Sematary sequel that was about Ellie Creed, but Paramount didn't want to do that, especially back in the 90s, because they didn't want to do a movie that had a woman as the protagonist, or especially a girl. Usually it's a virgin neglected to say that. Usually it's the final virgin that has to kill the monster. And that's pretty ancient. I mean, that goes to the heart of most mythologies, you know, from prehistoric times. So I don't know if you can do away with a character like that who's a part of our subconscious mythology. I think the woman usually is the one who's left to clean up the mess. In my experience, that's who cleans the mess up, the women. I don't see it's something we need to get rid of. I just think we need to take a little more interest in what's going on emotionally and psychologically with the women. That would be more interesting to me. That's the direction I'd like to see it go in.
And interestingly, the fact that you say, I mean, I personally am very afraid of these, you know, films that have gratuitous violence and blood and chainsaws and all that kind of stuff. But I am interested in thrillers that are a little, like Get Out was really interesting to me because it had less guts and more sort of psychological thriller. Mm-hmm. But Monica, I'm curious, what kind of horror stories would you want to see women either in or developing? Or is it more of a thriller if we want to get rid of this final girl trope? Like, how do you see that evolving?
I want them to have the opportunity to be able to do all kinds of stories, whether it be super bloody, whether it be super violent, or even if it's just a thriller, a slow burn, just waiting for, you know, things to pop up or anything like that. That's the problem, is that we haven't been able to see women get those kind of opportunities, and we haven't seen producers investing that kind of money in those projects.
And Monica, are there any folks that you've got your eye on right now in terms of projects or directors or actors that we should be paying attention to in this genre?
Oh, certainly. I was really excited by the movie Raw, which was a coming-of-age story about a cannibal. Alice Lowe's Prevenge, which is a British sort of horror comedy about a pregnant woman whose fetus drives her to go on a serial killing spree. There's a lot of people doing interesting stuff in this space, and they're just not getting the same attention or maybe funding, promotion. They're not getting those Blumhouse deals.
Do you think audiences care about who's behind the camera? Do you think it matters to them?
I think once they see what's out there, they will. There's, you know, all kinds of things that just don't make it to theaters, that just doesn't make it to the Midwest or doesn't even make it to, you know, outside of New York or LA. And I would love for people to check those out.
I think audiences relate to great storytelling and to being entertained in a new way and to having ideas, subconscious ideas tapped in their own psyche and unleashed. And that's what you get when you put women behind the camera and give women a voice. They don't have to know it's a woman that did it. But I think they relate to that women have different set of social experiences and they tell stories in a different way. And it's interesting. It doesn't mean that the other way is no good either. It needs to be a little more 50-50.
Mary Lambert is the director of the classic Stephen King adaptation, Pet Sematary. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thank you so much.
And Monica Castillo is a freelance film critic for RogerEbert.com. Great to talk to you, Monica.
Great talking with you, too.
Hi, this is Gina from Philadelphia. I think women are both stereotyped and empowered by horror films. Many of these films include a typically hot female, either scantily clad or nude, who is murdered with little or no character development. The empowerment part tends to come in at the end with the final girl. This is where we see the magic of them fighting back. There are so many final girls to choose from. We have classics like Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, Heather Langenkamp from Nightmare on Elm Street. Also shout outs to Neve Campbell in Scream and Ashley Lawrence in Hellraiser.
Hi, my name is Jerisa Lamont. I'm calling from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I love Joe Beth from Poltergeist. And yes, women are stereotyped in horror movies. That's why I'm glad Jamie Lee Curtis was awesome and broke the mold. Happy Halloween.
Hi, this is Amber from Seattle. Women have always been stereotyped, in American movies at least, as the weak, fragile first victim. But Descent from 2005 out of England really flips the script on that. This group of really intelligent, quick-thinking, physically strong women do battle in the darkness of a cavern with a horde of slimy human-adjacent monsters. Highly recommend.
Lots of calls from our audience on this topic today, and we love hearing from you. Keep the calls coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And that's our show for today. Have a good Halloween, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.